So tonight, I'm going to talk about sadness. Kind of a very tender topic. So much to say about this topic. There are, of course, many gradations of sadness, from, you know, little everyday things to really big ticket grief and loss. And one of the things that intrigues me about sadness are the permissions around it, the perceived permission of society to feel sad or express sadness, the permission we give ourselves. I think there's some sense in society that if it's a real big ticket loss, well, then of course you have permission to be upset about that. You know, anyone would be upset about that. But if it's kind of a little thing, it's almost like there's this message from society of, well, you know, get over it. What are you sad about, you know? And, of course, sadness, it is a perfectly ordinary human emotion. We all have this emotion. There's a woman who used to run the Sangha before me, and she just loved to say, emotions simply want to be felt. That's all emotions are asking. They want to be felt. And so it's funny, these messages that from society, this is a society that has a certain amount of impatience with someone who's sad. It has a certain amount of impatience with vulnerability in general. Or another way to say it is that it has fear of vulnerability. And certainly one approach to one's emotions and one kind of typical approach to the ordinary sadnesses of life is to cut off, to turn off vulnerability, to turn off feeling. And this is in some ways a very standard kind of conventional American practice. It really goes back to the Puritans in some way. The Puritans were very much about controlling and turning off. And of course, the problem with that is if you shut down your sensitivity, if you shut down your vulnerability, sure, you're not impacted by sadness, but you're not impacted by joy either. And life becomes kind of flat and stale. And there's a sense of sort of disconnection, almost like being a witness of life without actually participating in it. It's funny in a way, it's funny what we do with control. It's almost as if this kind of puritanical way of shutting oneself off, I mean, there's something painful about that, but it's sort of a low-level ongoing pain of disconnection that you control, as opposed to being open, and then you have the flux of everyday life, which you don't control, you know, and it's almost like people choose to have more pain when they can be in control. You see what I mean? It's a very funny thing. So it's a very human emotion. And our head does strange things with this emotion. Just as a pure emotion, no emotion is really problematic. An emotion, again, just wants to be felt. The head, though, does all kinds of things with sadness. It likes to spin stories, you know, why does this always happen to me, or blah, 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 and then, of course, that magnifies the feeling, so we can, you know, by one thing the strategic mind can do is amplify the feeling so that we feel a lot more sadness than just the emotion. You know, and certainly if we get involved in some kind of, you know, blame story or something like that, you know, that person did X and made me sad. Well, that almost anchors it in our body, because then we need to continue to have that emotion to justify that feeling of, you know, self-righteousness contained in the blame, you know? And so it's really under vastly underappreciated how much damage I do to myself when I blame somebody else for something. So what does Buddhism say about sadness? Fundamentally, Buddhism has no problem with our emotions. Emotions are emotions. They're life. They're perfectly fine. Buddhism does point out that when we get into our head and spin our thoughts, then that often amplifies emotions or brings them up to levels that they wouldn't ordinarily be. There's certainly a tremendous way that really a lot of our sadness, I think, actually has to do with expectations about the way that we think something's going to turn out and then opposed to the way that it actually turns out, this sort of thing. Buddhism often talks about, in one way or another, how the only source of joy is in the present moment. All life, all vitality, all joy is in the present moment. And so insofar as we're directing emotional energy to the past or the future, we're kind of setting ourselves up for problems, you know, because we're directing our emotion to where there fundamentally isn't, you might say, isn't the substance of life. So I want to talk a little also about the special cases of the big ticket sadness, you know, grief, and, you know, grief for tremendous loss of one kind or another. It's certainly true that there's a way that society gives permission for that in a way. It's like, you know, you experience a great loss, then, you know, for that month or so, then society kind of recognizes, okay, you know, you can be grieving. But then it's like, you know, 4 months later, you know, is that still bothering you? You know, this sort of thing. And grief, of course, is a very long process. For anyone who has been through grief, you certainly know this, that it takes, you know, the cycle of grief is well over a year long. And again, a perfectly natural experience. We all go through it. There's nothing wrong with feeling emotions. Emotions simply want to be felt. In fact, in some ways, the easiest way to get through grief is to do what's initially hard and just allow yourself to feel everything you feel. Because the more you feel, the less you'll be holding on to later. I'll also say that sadness can be a very important clue. And by what I mean by that is, suppose there's a little, you know, little disappointment in life, but then it really makes me sad, and I realize I'm kind of sad out of proportion to whatever this little event was. It's often a clue to some place in us that's holding sadness. You know, this way that, say, this person didn't pay attention to me in this particular situation might be bringing up some way that I felt like I was never getting the attention that I wanted or something like that. You know, and all these places within us, again, even the emotion that we've been holding for 10, 20 years in us, all those emotions, again, just want to be felt. You know, and to accept them and to just feel them for what they are, that goes a long way to clearing them. So what is the consolation that Buddhism has to offer? Well, it's interesting because I think there's this kind of child's conception that, you know, the ideal world would be all happiness and no sadness, you know? And of course, that's not life. It really, in some ways, is kind of a child's conception of what perfection would be, you know? And it's ironic that I think it's really kind of the conventional understanding of what the Christian heaven is, and I think it's some people's understanding of what nirvana is. You know, all happiness, no sadness. And Buddhism is a little bit different. I mean, insofar as we are out of our heads and in our bodies more, certainly that spares us the extra agony that the strategic mind can create. And also, insofar as we're just paying attention and in our body more, we're feeling more directly, and just by feeling more directly, we allow something to pass through us more quickly. Certainly by centering our energy in the present moment, that is another way that we save ourselves from a tremendous amount of heartache. And it's funny, it's something we even know neurobiologically, that when I'm in a mode of curiosity, forward approach, engaging with the world, learning, exploring, discovering, that mode is, it's a profound producer of optimism, hope, it is antidepressive, it's even antalgesic. In other words, it takes the edge off of physical pain to be in that mode. And it's funny because there's such a human tendency when we're sad about something or when we're hurt, we want to kind of lick our wounds and withdraw, and you know, a little bit of that is fine, but it's ultimately that opening up and exploring the world that itself brings a kind of internal consolation. You know, this is a wonderful line from a poem by Mary Oliver. You know, tell me about despair, yours, and I will tell you mine, but meanwhile the world goes on. Tell me about despair, yours, and I will tell you mine, but meanwhile the world goes on. And that there's just something about opening to life and opening to the wonder of life that in a way puts ourselves in perspective, you know, in a way helps us to take ourselves less seriously, you know. There's another line from Rumi. In fact, I included this on the quote sheet. He says, in the moment you are drunk on yourself, you lock yourself away in cloud after cloud of grief. But in the moment you leap free of yourself, the moon catches you and hugs you in its arms. So a very far-flung poetic image from Mr. Rumi. But there's, you know, it makes all the difference of the world whether I'm going to be sad and in here or acknowledging my sadness and moving forward into life. So I'll hand out the quotes. I often have a quote sheet. I used to be a teacher. Yeah. The first is a long passage from David White, the poet, and I'll read this. This is actually from a book that he's written called Consolations, which is just reflections, you know it, yeah. Just reflections on individual important words. Bless you. Solace is the beautiful, imaginative home we make where disappointment can go to be rehabilitated. When life does not add up in any way, we must turn to the part of us that has never wanted a life of simple calculation. Solace is found in allowing the body's innate wisdom to come to the fore, the part of us that already knows it is mortal and must take its leave like everything else, and leading us, when the mind cannot bear what it is seeing or hearing, to the bird song in the tree above our head, even as we are told of a death, each note an essence of mourning and mourning. Of the current of life moving on, but somehow also most beautifully carrying, bearing, and even celebrating the life we have just lost. A life we could not see or appreciate until it was taken from us. To be consoled is to be invited into the terrible ground of beauty, open which our inevitable disappearance stands, to a voice that does not soothe falsely, but touches the epicenter of our pain, or articulates the essence of our loss, and then emancipates us into both life and death as an equal birthright. So that's a very deep passage. We'll go back to that. One that I found from Mr. Confucius, we should feel sorrow but not sink under its oppression. And a lot of the oppression comes again from what the mind does with, oh, it's always me, and blah, blah, you know, blah, blah, blah. And then there's this wonderful line also from the Analects, the writing of Confucius, which I find very touching. If he was seated next to someone in mourning, the master never ate his full. And just this idea of the tremendous empathy with which Confucius moved through life. Confucius doesn't get a whole lot of good press these days, so. Then the Rumi quote, I won't quote that again. Then Meister Eckhart, the great Christian mystic, truly, it is in the darkness that one finds the light. So when we are in sorrow, then this light is nearest of all to us. Sometimes we have the most profound experience of the sacred when we're a bit helpless ourselves, you know. We're just not as open when we're totally in control of ourselves, you know. From La Fontaine, sadness flies away on the wings of time. From the poet Shelley, the pleasure that is in sorrow is sweeter than the pleasure of pleasure itself. That's an interesting paradoxical one. From Franz Schubert, who may be the greatest songwriter ever, nobody understands another's sorrow, and nobody another's joy. From Victor Hugo, sorrow is a fruit. God does not make it grow on limbs too weak to bear it. And then a couple touching ones from Longfellow. If we could read the secret history of our enemies, we should find in each man's life sorrow and suffering enough to disarm all hostility. And also from Longfellow, every man has his secret sorrow which the world knows not, and ofttimes we call a man cold when he is only sad. From the great Harriet Beecher Stowe, any mind that is capable of real sorrow is capable of good. This great one from Mark Twain, the secret source of humor is not joy but sorrow. There is no humor in heaven. From Mr. Nietzsche, who wasn't necessarily the most cheerful man himself, what if some day or night a demon were to steal after you into your loneliest loneliness and say to you, the life as you live it now and have lived it, you will have to live once more and innumerable times more. Would you not throw yourself down and gnash your teeth and curse the demon who spoke you thus? Or have you once experienced a tremendous moment when you would have answered him, you are a god, and I have never heard anything more divine? This whole idea, his idea that yes, that joy wants eternity. Joy says yes to eternity. And really, to have a genuine experience of joy, we're really saying yes to everything. Like, we want everything experienced in eternity. Carl Jung, just quite simple, the word happy would lose its meaning if it were not balanced by sadness. Khalil Gibran says, sadness is but a wall between two gardens. I love that. Jessamine West says, the source of one's joy is also the source of one's sorrow. And similarly, Jim Rohn says, the walls we build around us to keep out sadness also keep out joy. Joni Mitchell says, sorrow is so easy to express and yet so hard to tell. Dirk Benedict says, life has never been easy, nor was it meant to be. It is a matter of being joyous in the face of sorrow. The writer Sarah Ban Brechneth says, misery is by our own nature a passing phase of sorrow, and one that does not linger uninvited. Her sojourn seems to be part of life's required curriculum, perhaps because misery endows us with compassion and empathy. From the Greek mystic Eckhart Tolle, boredom, anger, sadness, and fear are not yours, not personal. They are conditions of the human mind. They come and go. Nothing that comes and goes is you. And from the president of Mexico, behind every crime is a story of sadness. So true.